Hi there, and welcome to Prevention Profiles Take 5. This is Rich Lucy with the Drug Enforcement Administration's Community Outreach and Prevention Support Section. And I'm glad you're able to join us on this next edition of our podcast series, Prevention Profiles Take 5. This is our third episode in the relatively new podcast series. And as a reminder, this is an opportunity for me to interview federal, national, state, and local individuals around the country who are working specifically around drug abuse prevention issues in higher education. And I am very pleased to have today a really good colleague who I've admired for a very long time and a friend, Jason Kilmer from the University of Washington. And a little bit about Jason before we get started into our five questions. Dr. Jason Kilmer received his PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Washington in 1997, and he currently works at the University of Washington in both a research capacity and a student affairs capacity. He is an associate professor in psychiatry and behavioral sciences and the assistant director of health and wellness for alcohol and other drug education. Jason works tirelessly to increase student access to evidence-based approaches, and he has written numerous publications on the impact of college student substance use. So, Jason, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. What a nice introduction, and it's a pleasure to do this with you today.
Absolutely. So, the premise around the whole podcast series, each episode, is centered around five specific questions that have been developed specifically for you. So, I'm going to jump right into our first question. And I'm going to preface the first question by stating that under federal law, a reminder that recreational and medical use of marijuana is illegal. Now, with that being said, in November 2012, voters in Washington state approved an initiative that legalizes marijuana use for adults 21 and older. So, Jason, from your perspective, what has been the biggest impact of that event on Washington state's colleges and universities?
That's a great question. I think probably one of the biggest impacts has been the need for schools to sort out what could be perceived as mixed messages to our students. You know, we've got state law, we've got federal law, and all colleges and universities need to demonstrate compliance with the Drug-Free Schools and Campus Regulations as part of the Drug-Free Schools and Communities Act. So on college campuses, independent of what city they're in, what state they're in, we've tried to continue to make clear that use, possession, public use remains illegal. But, you know, when people aren't entirely sure about, I'm in a state where it's legal, so what does that mean for me? It's really trying to make sure that as best as we can, those mixed messages can be reduced. Part of that involves consistent enforcement. Part of that involves, you know, really making sure that we're trying to clarify what the science really says. I think the other thing we're trying to be mindful of on college campuses is, you know, and this is as important for students to be aware of as it is their parents to be aware of, is the fact that there's research that is clearly showing that the more frequently people are using marijuana, the more that's associated with taking longer to graduate, discontinuous enrollment in school, skipping class, lower grade point averages. And even when you include alcohol in the equation, alcohol and marijuana, the more heavily people use both, the more that's associated with lower GPA. But when entered into some of the same predictive models, the effects of alcohol become a little less strong, if not even non-significant. So there's so many important conversations happening on college campuses about how we make college more affordable for everyone. And those are fantastic conversations that we could and should be having. But part of that involves getting out on time. Part of that involves not taking 5, 6, 7 years to get out of school and to graduate. And so if substance use is impacting student success, we have to be mindful that what we do around alcohol and marijuana use and other drug use will pay dividends in the classroom. And so it's really keeping that focus on the importance of prevention.
So you brought up a couple of really good foundational principles there. Consistent enforcement and follow the science. I mean, that
absolutely,
those are two hallmarks of a comprehensive prevention program. And I'm glad you brought that up and you wove in the alcohol issue, because that's an excellent segue into my second question. Because you have a long history of studying the impact of alcohol misuse among college students, as well as looking at the impact of marijuana use among youth and young adults. So what lessons learned around alcohol misuse prevention also apply to marijuana use prevention?
You know, so much of that is exactly what we're trying to even sort out, and it really is a thoughtful question, because it's with less literature on almost best practices in prevention, especially with a college student population, you know, these changes are very, very new. And so even when people say, well, what are the long-term effects of this, or what are the outcomes of that, most of this around our legislation, as you pointed out, is only a little over 5 years ago. We know from the alcohol world that if you give fact-only, information-only type of prevention programs, you will see an increase in knowledge, but no change in behavior. So if we're trying to reduce risks or harms or even use itself, giving information will increase knowledge, but won't necessarily change behavior. Sometimes we want to increase knowledge, and that's actually one of the things we're looking to do. So I think of examples of that in the alcohol world is what makes up a standard drink. If you let people know what a standard drink is, doesn't necessarily going to mean that you'll change what they do unless you can tie it back into why it matters related to their behavior. But someone who doesn't understand that, you know, the larger container of this versus that might mean more standard drinks, we want to get everyone at least on the same page. Another great example, I think, recognizing signs of alcohol poisoning. There's been research that's been done that looks at reasons why students might not call for help in an alcohol emergency. And one of the primary reasons is they're not sure if help is needed. And so increasing that knowledge doesn't necessarily mean they'll do something differently. That's on us to look at the behavioral implications beyond that. But it does mean we have to at least make sure that if there is some information that we're trying to at least level the playing field from a knowledge standpoint, that we can do that. So, you know, sometimes when it comes to marijuana use, we do want to increase knowledge. But if we're looking at what lessons we can take from alcohol prevention, I think that probably the most important thing on individually focused approaches is we have to focus on what's most important to the student that we're working with. We could have all the science and facts in the world, but if that's less relevant to any student's situation, that's not going to be as useful. We know that in the alcohol world, if we can elicit from the student we're working with personally relevant reasons to change, that could prompt thinking about change or even commitment to change. So for the student that says, I really want to do well in school, that's my value or my goal. If the status quo is, I'm really struggling with memory, attention, concentration, we can actually connect the dots and show ways in which the more people use marijuana, the more those cognitive effects are impacted. And if that prompts either thinking about change or asking about change, that would be consistent with some of the best practices we have with alcohol. Additionally, I will say environmental approaches and individual focus approaches have to work side by side. And that's something we've definitely learned from the alcohol prevention world. And I imagine that would apply very well to the marijuana prevention world as well.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly, I'm glad you mentioned that last piece. And, you know, in prevention, we sometimes talk about chasing the drug, which is something we try to avoid. I know that it's inevitable sometimes and it's hard to resist, but you know, whether it's alcohol issues, marijuana, and certainly with opioids and such, it feels like we're just chasing the drug du jour. But there are certain underlying really sound prevention principles that apply regardless of what drug you're, you know, chasing, so to speak. You've mentioned those, I think, really well in terms of what we are looking at in terms of what we can learn from alcohol misuse prevention and how we can start applying that to marijuana use. So that's really helpful, and I'm sure that the listeners to the podcast will appreciate that. You know, you talk a little bit about there's, you know, little that these changes, regardless of the state, I mean, Washington and Colorado have been about 5 years now. And there certainly have been several other states since then that have gone in this direction. And so there is not a lot of research necessarily that is available. But I wanted to talk a little bit about evidence-based strategies. Both the College AIM, which is the College Alcohol Intervention Matrix, developed by the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, and SAMHSA's National Registry of Evidence-Based Programs and Practices, many familiarly know that as NREP, both of those are intended to help identify effective alcohol and drug abuse prevention interventions. So as a field, how do you think we're doing in identifying and actually implementing evidence-based practices to prevent drug abuse among college students?
It's a great distinction because there's a big difference, I think, between identifying and implementing. We've definitely come a long way with alcohol. If you look at the mid-80s, for example, the number of published articles in the scientific literature showing a reduction in alcohol use consequences or both was actually none. By 2002, the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism was able to say, here are different tiers of effectiveness because the prevention literature had grown enough to actually summarize what was out there. With the 2015 release of College AIM, we now have almost 60 individually and environmentally focused strategies that are rated in College AIM. So we've definitely come quite a long ways. One challenge, at least, with other substances, we've just got a lot farther to go. With alcohol, we can see in the published literature examples of if someone makes the choice to drink, for example, ways to do that in a less dangerous or less risky way. We don't have a lot of those same guidelines for harm reduction with other substances. So that definitely is one thing we're mindful of. There's also challenges, believe it or not, even with methodology and playing catch up. With alcohol, we can give someone a standardized, reliable, and valid measure that says, we're going to ask you to consider your drinking over a typical week. Here's what a standard drink is, and we can define that. We're not really there in terms of looking at what is a standard amount, for example, of marijuana use. Mm-hmm. With alcohol, you can look on a can or bottle and look at the alcohol by volume. With marijuana, depending on how people are getting it, outside with the exception of some legal states that have taken efforts to have things labeled, people don't actually know the potency of what they're getting. Right. So part of evaluating evidence-based practices is having good outcome data to look at the impact. And if we don't have good means of measurement, that can be a real challenge.
Yeah.
I think that the implementing part, though, that winds up being one of the big challenges. With alcohol, there are definitely identified strategies that work. And the question is, are schools getting students connected to them in an effective way? There's a quote I saw by Dean Fixon that I think is really fantastic that said, the use of effective interventions without implementation strategies is like serum without a syringe. The cure is available, but the delivery system is not. Mm. And I think that's so important that, if we had vaccines but no way to get it to people, the cure is available, the delivery system is not. If we have effective intervention approaches, are we appropriately and efficiently getting people connected to them? And that's where you see efforts on college campuses related to everything from screening and brief intervention with referral to treatment, as well as, again, things like consistent enforcement. If people have effective approaches with mandated students following a policy violation, well, the only way you're going to get people there is if there's an enforcement of those and consistent enforcement once they go through conduct, as an example. Mm-hmm. So those types of efforts around implementation as well as identification continue to be something we look at.
Yeah, when I was developing the question, actually, I was really intentional about those two words, and so I'm glad you picked up on it. I wasn't like looking for that per se, but I'm glad that you differentiated the importance of both of those things. My concern is, I think that, well, you've mentioned it, like with the alcohol issue, we are way past the time of not knowing what works, because we do know what works, right?
Correct.
I mean, we've known since 2002, essentially, when the NIAAA came out with the four tiers of effectiveness, which was then enhanced with College AIM. But as I said before, with the whole chasing the drug issue, we've known for a long time in prevention science what works well. I think of the strategic prevention framework, for instance. Those five steps can be applied to matter whatever drug you're using. So we know how to approach things. It's just, I think, sometimes comes down to the will to implement them.
Absolutely.
So, and then I'm also going to, by the way, follow up with you to get that quote, because I really appreciated that. So I might have you send that to me.
You got it.
I'm going to move on to our fourth question. A couple of years ago, I had the pleasure, and I was so excited that you and I were finally going to get a chance to co-present a workshop together. And we did at the NASPA Strategies Conference. That session, you'll recall, was called Prevention's Excellent Adventure, where we've been, where we are, and where we're going. Had a great time putting it together, and I really enjoyed our session, and I believe that our audience did as well. But we both know that sometimes the prevention journey isn't so excellent. And as someone who works in research and student affairs, what keeps you up at night when it comes to preventing drug abuse among college students?
Well, first, let me also say that that tag team with you was easily one of the most rewarding opportunities in terms of my work at conference presentations. You've been such a good friend to higher education for a long time, and having the chance to tag team you with you was really great. You also know me well, because I am a worrier, so asking me what keeps me up at night is unfortunately an often lengthy list. I do what I can to make that list feel shorter.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are a lot of things that I think are anxiety-provoking right now. If I try and keep that list somewhat manageable, I do worry about the abstainer who mistakenly thinks they're the only one on their campus that doesn't drink. Most students don't drink heavily. And there are, you know, depending on which survey you look at, well over 20%, if not higher, of students that do not drink at all. And whether those students are lifelong abstainers, students in recovery, students that used to drink, but it's been more than 12 months, it's important for those students to know they're not alone and to feel supported in the decision to not drink. I do worry about high-risk events. You're talking to me, final start at my campus in 19 hours. Mm. And so then we're going to have spring break. There's been some research that looks at, among first-year students, the week of spring break being the single heaviest quantity in terms of drinking week of a first-year college student's first year of school. Mm. 21st birthdays or 21 runs. These high-risk events where even if people don't typically drink heavily, if it's associated with risk-taking, some of the tragic things that can happen there. I think there's some anxiety about that. There's even been research, Rich, that is probably outside the scope of what we're talking about now, but that looks at the role of, for our students that do drink heavily and often, who may be able to, in quotes, hold their liquor, the sense of having tolerance. There's research that shows that there's a big environmental component to that. For decades, we thought that tolerance was very physical, but now there's research that pretty convincingly shows that there's an environmental element. If you look at Pavlov and Pavlovian conditioning, we can make a dog salivate when a bell rings. If someone always drinks around the same group of friends in the same environment, in essence, every time they drink, they're pairing that environment and those friends with alcohol. Why that matters is we know in physiology, there's something called the opponent process theory that says if you shove the body one way, the body shoves back the other. We jack up the heat, people sweat. We make it really cold, people shiver. If you have a drug like alcohol, as a depressant, slows down the central nervous system. Someone drinks, slows down the body. Drinks, slows down the body. In time, in response to cues that signal that alcohol is about to show up, the body will make an anticipatory response in the direction opposite the way the drug acts. In essence, the body prepares to receive the drug. Hmm. And researchers call this a conditioned compensatory response. When that happens, if someone drinks the same amount they always do, they might not feel it the same way because there's the same depressant dose, but in some ways it's being offset by this compensatory response. So they tend to drink more. They don't look any different, but they are getting to a higher blood alcohol level. So imagine if someone develops tolerance and then goes to an environment they've never been, like a road trip during spring break. All the cues associated with their drinking are no longer there. And if they drink the same amount they drank 1 week earlier, it could hit them much, much, much harder and increase risk for overdose. So in answering your question about what else keeps me up at night, technically, as much as I love working with college students, even the fall, what do our campuses represent to our incoming first-year students? People for whom our campuses are a brand-new environment. And for those who come into college already drinking and potentially heavily, who have tolerance, the word used in our field is the word fail. Tolerance fails to fall someone to a new set of cues. So short of making sure everyone knows about who Pavlov is, understanding that in one fell swoop, someone who's done something routinely, that same behavior could hit them so much harder is very, very concerning to me.
Wow.
I can continue with this list unless...
You know, whenever I go to conferences and I learn now doing these podcasts, I've been doing this now for 25 plus years. I always try to learn something new coming out of these workshop sessions or interviews. And I got to tell you, that right there is for me something new. I had not known that. Is that relatively new?
The first article that really got our attention was in 2002 by Shepard Siegel and Barbara Ramos. And the research that's come out since that is, to me, absolutely mind-blowing. There's been research that even shows that taste is a cue. If someone always drinks the same drink, in essence, when that taste and smell, when they smell it, when they take a sip, that's a cue. It's a cue that tells the body, hello, here comes my favorite drink. Mm. There was even a study out of Canada where the drinking age is lower, where they had students drink a drink that looked, tasted, and smelled like beer. Everything about it was familiar. They had another drink that was the same size, the same alcohol by volume, got them to the same blood alcohol level, but it was really, really bright blue and really pepperminty. When students drank a drink that had who drinks blue peppermint drink? When someone drinks a drink that was completely novel, their subjective self-report is that it was hitting them harder. What's striking is that objectively, they actually showed greater signs of impairment. A drink that was the exact same alcohol by volume got them to the same blood alcohol level that had novel taste and smell cues actually hit them harder. So go back to the idea of a 21 run. If someone is going to a bar for the first time, what does that bar represent to them? A brand new environment. The tolerance they had in their room or in their friend's room will fail to follow them when they go out. And this has been replicated with other substances even. And so the research on this, I think, thanks to Siegel and colleagues, has really, really grown. And the implications for us on college campuses, to me, are absolutely huge.
Wow. Well, yeah, that is certainly for the listeners. Hopefully they'll take away from that as well, something additional for them to look into and learn more about. Okay, Jason, now thanks for telling us, unfortunately, those things that keep you up at night, and those of us that work in prevention, for as long as we have, we all have those moments, unfortunately, in our field. But as I move into our fifth question, I'll turn this and flip it on a more positive note. I want to give you the opportunity to talk to your peers, those professionals that are working to prevent drug abuse among college students. What do you want to say to encourage them?
I genuinely believe, I hope no one ever questions the value of what we do in prevention. I also think we're all in this together. I would fear the person that claims they have all the answers, and that's definitely not me. And I know that the number of times something has come up, the importance of consulting with peers, getting support from peers, and really trying to get a sense of lessons learned becomes so important. The more we can collaborate, the more we can be mindful of not reinventing the wheel, and the more we can keep up with changing trends, the better. Part of keeping up with changing trends includes things like conference attendance, listening to podcasts, listening to webinars, but also doing what we can to bridge the gap between science and practice. I feel lucky that I have a job that lets me do that on a daily basis with a foot in both the research world and the student affairs world. But the number of journal articles that are out there, that it's almost impossible to kind of stay up on all of them. It's really doing what we can to make sure that the research is informing what we do, but that also what we do is informing some of the research that's taking place. So really approaching things as collaboratively as possible and not losing sight of how truly valuable prevention is on college campuses, I think is essential.
Absolutely. And pick up on a phrase that you used to have the folks listening to this podcast and others to keep up with changing trends. I mean, that's a real big part of what we do in prevention. It's never stagnant. It's always changing, and we always are trying to stay a step ahead, if you will. And I really appreciate the advice that you gave.
So, can I say to you, Rich, that
yeah.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Part of trying to stay up is that sometimes it feels like, we're trying to research something that's moving so quickly. I think one of the great examples of that, you asked a question about marijuana use. When we look at changes in potency over the last 20 years, in some ways, this is a completely different animal than what we were looking at even in the 80s, 90s, certainly even as recent as 5 years ago.
Right.
In a state like mine, where there's been legal marijuana average potency is even higher than what we're seeing in the nation. And so if we're truly trying to say we want to make sure that we're making science-based decisions, what does the science say about, you know, cannabis in 2018, a lot of that research hasn't been done yet. And so I do think that there's a degree of playing catch-up as well. So you're very right. We want to stay up on it as much as possible, but where one of the extra challenges becomes when the very thing we're trying to research is changing so quickly.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on. You've given, in just five questions, in each one of those five questions, you gave some great advice and things for people to hang on to and to look into further. And so we're going to close with that, Jason. I really can't thank you enough to participating in our podcast series. And
it's completely my honor. Thanks for the opportunity to do this.
Absolutely. And I'll certainly be talking to you soon. And to all the listeners who've been tuning into our podcast series, we really appreciate it. And we'll be in touch very soon. Thank you and have a good day.